nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, thank you. So what I'd like to do as a follow-up of what I did last week is talk about designing of the CMOS circuits, again, in the nanometer regime. Last time I talked about process variation, and today I'd like to focus on leakage and leakage control techniques. So as I mentioned last time also, but just for the sake of completeness, the challenges ahead in the nanometer regime are, of course, one of the biggest problems is maintaining an ion-to-ion ratio over different technology generations. So if you keep on scaling your technology, turns out it's, the ion-to-ion ratio is not as good as what it used to be in the good old days of you know, 1 micron technology. And partly because of the fact that you're scaling your devices, and beyond a certain point, in order to get your improvement in the performance of your designs, there's a need to scale the threshold voltage of the transistors. And if you scale the threshold voltage of the transistors, turns out that the sub-threshold component of the leakage current increases, and that increases exponentially, and there's nothing like free lunch. And so what happens is your leakage increases, and there's a need to actually consider leakage control techniques in CMOS circuits. I talked about variation last time, so I'm not going to go into the details of it. And again, in the future technology generations, and maybe even today, there's a need to consider process variations. And in a way, you're going to be looking at designing with unreliable components. And finally, I talked a little bit in the last lecture on reliability and NBTI in particular. And again, that is also expected to be a major problem in the nanoscale technology. But as I mentioned, the focus of today's lecture is going to be on power consumption, and in particular, actually, leakage current and leakage tolerance. Now, there are different components of power dissipation in a CMOS circuit, and one of the major components turns out to be the dynamic component of power dissipation, which people were actually certainly worried about in the earlier generations. It's not that you can ignore that dynamic component of power dissipation, and we'll see that it's actually a function of the supply voltage, square of the supply voltage. And people are working towards, you know, different methodologies or coming up with different techniques to reduce that component of the power dissipation, looking at the circuit level, you know, scaling down the supply voltage, looking at, you know, architectural level, and so on. And there's another component of power dissipation, which is at the circuit level. One can think of having a short circuit power, meaning thereby that for a short period of time when the input is rising or falling, the PMOS and the NMOS transistors in the NMOS circuit are all going to be on for a short period of time. And due to that, there can be a direct connection from VDD to ground, and there can be a good amount of power dissipation due to that. And one can take care of that by proper sizing the circuit. But today, again, as I mentioned, my primary focus is going to be on leakage power dissipation, and it turns out in nanoscale technologies, leakage turns out to be one of the major problems. So let's look at, before I go into leakage, just to, for the completeness sake, I thought I'll just mention about the dynamic component of the power dissipation. So that's usually from the textbook. You know, what you really see is that if you look at an inverter, and if you, let's say, if I have a falling transition at the input of this inverter, the transistor that turns out to be important is this PMOS transistor, which would be charging this capacitance. And so the energy dissipated per transition, one can show, you know, just a little bit of integration here showing that, that the energy dissipation is going to be equal to CL, which is the output capacitance, times VDD squared divided by 2. And in the, when I have a rising transition following that a falling transition, there's going to be another CL VDD squared divided by 2 amount of power dissipation due to that. So in a complete cycle, the power dissipation is going to be CL times VDD squared. Now, the interesting thing to note is that that is not a function of the size of these transistors and so on. So that's something very, very important to note. So I'm not going to be talking about the dynamic component of the power dissipation, but it turns out, of course, from these equations, we see that one of the good ways of reducing this power dissipation would be to scale the supply voltage, let's say, by a factor of 2. But of course, if I scale the supply voltage by a factor of 2, one can show that I can get a large improvement in power dissipation, but certainly my delay is going to get affected. So there's not a good way of like reducing this component of power dissipation. People have looked at reducing the supply voltage, maybe looking at parallel processing or pipelining to maintain the throughput, and also at the same time reducing this component, which is a CL or effective switch capacitance of the circuit, using various means. But let me focus on leakage, and leakage turns out to be one of the major components of power dissipation in today's technology. And if you look at the microprocessors of today, it turns out that the power dissipation, and I'm quoting Shekhar Borkar of Intel, turns out the power dissipation due to the leakage can be as high as about 30 to 35% of the total power dissipation of the circuit. Again, you have to remember that, you know, the high temperature leakage is going to be a lot higher than, you know, the low temperature leakage. And when the circuits are operating, maybe 10% of the transistors are going to be switching, and the rest of the time, they're actually going to be leaking. So that turns out is also a good amount of power dissipation due to this 10% switching thing. So the leakage component, there are several different components of leakage power dissipation. And so if I look at a bulk CMOS technology, let's say, and the major component turns out to be the sub-threshold component, which is when VGS of the transistor is less than the threshold voltage, there's going to be current flowing through these devices. And that current turns out to be, well, certainly the major component in a technology which was about, which is about, let's say, 180 nanometers or 130 nanometers, that turns out to be the major component of the leakage current. But in order to maintain short channel effects in these transistors, good short channel effect in these transistors, there's a need to not only scale the devices, but also at the same time make these oxide to be thinner, so that you can have a good aspect ratio of the device, which is going to give you a better short channel effect. But it turns out if your oxide thickness, oxide is too thin, there can be gate tunneling component. And there are different components of this gate tunneling current. Gate to body, gate to source, gate to drain overlap, and so on. And finally, if you look at, for example, again, these nanoscale transistors, these transistors today actually look quite different from the transistors of yesteryear, so to say. There is a need for this halo doping. You need actually a P-plus region right here near the source and also in the drain region. The P-plus region is required to maintain a good drain-induced barrier lowering for these transistors and to, again, to maintain a good short channel effect. But unfortunately, what happens is all these transistors during regular operation of the circuit are going to be reverse biased. And due to that, what can happen potentially is that you have a P-plus and an N-plus region. And when they're strongly reverse biased, what can happen is there can be a band-to-band tunneling component of the leakage current. So again, if we look at a 90 nanometer or a 65 nanometer transistor, all these leakage components at, you know, room temperature turn out to be quite important. But when it comes to high temperature leakage current, it turns out sub-threshold, which is a very, very strong function of temperature, is a dominant component of leakage even today. And the other components that I talked about, the gate leakage component or, for example, the junction band-to-band tunneling component, are weak functions of temperature, so they're not going to be that dominant at high temperature, meaning thereby during the active mode of operation. So active leakage turns out to be, again, it's going to be the major component being sub-threshold component. And there's something actually good about it. I mean, I shouldn't say that leakage is good, but there's something good about it in the sense that there are good ways of controlling sub-threshold leakage. You know, I can figure out good circuit techniques, or in fact, even at the architecture level, good techniques to reduce this component during regular operations of the circuit. However, I do not possibly have good methods of reducing the gate leakage component, or in fact, even the junction band-to-band tunneling component of the leakage current. And later on, we'll see that the sub-threshold component is kind of interesting too. So you can actually operate circuits below the, if you scale down the supply voltage below the threshold of the transistor, it turns out it still works pretty well. So we'll also try to address that issue later on. Now, what one can do is, given any sort of, you know, device doping profile and device geometry, so what one can do is one can find out the different components of leakage current. Now, I'm not going into the details of the analysis here or the modeling part, but it turns out you can model each of these components of the leakage current, the gate tunneling leakage, let's say, and the different components of the gate tunneling leakage, or, for example, the sub-threshold leakage or the junction band-to-band tunneling component in terms of voltage-controlled current sources. So now, once we are able to model it, which I'm not showing here, it can be shown that I can actually have for each of these gate to drain overlap or gate to source overlap gate leakage, what I can do is I can model them as voltage controlled current sources. And so given any sort of, let's say for this, for the timing, let's assume these are bulk transistors. So if I know the doping profile, I can possibly come up with a sum of current sources model like this, which is basically the drain source and the gate of the transistor and of course the substrate. And in between those, I have different, voltage control current sources representing the different components of leakage current. So in other words, what I'm able to do now is, again, though I didn't talk about the modeling part because that's going to take a little bit of time, it turns out what I can really do is I can actually have, given the device geometry and the doping profile, I can come up with this current, the modeling of the different components of leakage current, represent it as different voltage control current sources. And then, of course, I can actually take the SPICE route or I can take MATLAB route to estimate the power dissipation or the leakage power dissipation in different circuit configuration. And we'll see that it's going to be very much dependent on what the input conditions are for the circuit. So now that, let's say, we're able to estimate leakage current in nanoscale technologies, and in particular, let's say, bulk CMOS technologies, one can certainly do an analysis for, let's say, FinFETs or other devices too, there's a need to now figure out what would be a good way of reducing the leakage current in logic and memory circuits. So before I go into the logic and memory circuits, let's try to analyze certain things that we can do for leakage control or reduction of leakage. So first technique that I'm going to be talking about, and by the way, this technique would be applicable to both logic and memory, is what's called transistor stacking, meaning that or source biasing or supply gating. And why we call it source biasing or supply gating is going to be clear in just a minute. So if I were actually to have a transistor with a gate of the NMOS transistor connected to zero and the drain connected to a voltage VD, it turns out that, if I look at the log of IDS versus VGS characteristic, if I were to connect the source to ground, then I'm going to be operating somewhere here. I'm not showing the super threshold region for this transistor, but for the sub-threshold region, if VGS is equal to zero, I'm going to be operating somewhere here. But somehow, if I'm able to stick in a voltage source right here, and how we do that is going to be clear in the following slides. So if I'm able to stick in a voltage source there, then it turns out the VGS of this transistor is going to be negative. So now if VGS is negative, I'm going to be operating somewhere right here. What it really means is that my leakage current or the subthreshold component of the leakage current has gone down and it has gone down exponentially. Okay, so that's basically the factor that I'm going to be using in what's called supply gating or transistor stacking, or in other words, or source biasing. In other words, what I'm really doing is that I'm putting a bias to the source of this transistor to get the improvement in leakage current. Now, a few other things one has to look at is certainly when VDS reduces, then VT increases, and that's basically the drain-induced barrier lowering effect. And the other second order effect that I need to consider is that the body effect, since if the source voltage changes, the threshold voltage also changes. So these effects certainly have to be considered. So let's see how we can apply this source voltage. And this is also called, as I said, transistor stacking. And again, that's going to be clear in just a moment why we call it transistor stacking. So if I have one transistor, an NMOS transistor connected in a configuration like this with a gate connected to zero, the leakage current turns out to be, let's say, I. Now, if I were to look at the leakage current of a stack of two transistors like this, and that's why it's called a stacking technique, if I add an extra transistor with a gate connected to zero for that transistor, turns out that the VGS of this transistor is zero. However, the VGS of this transistor is actually going to be negative because there's going to be some leakage current flowing through these devices and there's going to be some voltage drop. So the voltage right here is going to be some voltage VM depending on the size of these transistors. And so VGS of this transistor is going to be negative. Now, since VGS of this transistor is negative and I'm working in the exponential region, the overall leakage current is really going to be dominated by the leakage of this particular transistor because the same leakage current flows to these guys, right? So VGS negative basically dominates the leakage. And hence, if you look at the leakage of this particular configuration of two stacked transistors versus one transistor, Turns out, again, I get a large improvement in leakage current. How much? Depends on the size of these transistors, but of the order of about 10 to 15x if you do it right. So it's, again, in the I'm playing with exponential changes of the leakage current due to VGS, and I can get a large improvement in leakage current if I do that. And again, hopefully it's clear now why it's called source biasing also, because what I'm really doing is, if this is my logic transistor, I'm able to put a bias to the source of this transistor and thereby get an improvement in leakage current. Or I'm stacking two transistors, or we'll see that this is the same technique that I'm gating the ground of this transistor, the gating the ground of this particular transistor. So these techniques are also called, you know, gated ground, or, you know, supply gating or stacking, and so on. Question, of course, is that how is this configuration 0, 0 versus 1, 0 going to be? Certainly, one can show that this 0, 0 configuration is going to be a lot better than the 1, 0 configuration in terms of leakage improvement. Now, we can be really greedy and say, hey, you know, one transistor gave me a leakage improvement. Is it possible that, you know, I'm going to put two transistors gave me an improvement. Is it possible that I'm going to put three transistors in series and get, you know, further improvement in leakage current? Now, it turns out, yes, you can certainly have a third transistor and get an improvement in leakage current if you do that. However, there's going to be a diminishing return, and a two versus three transistors turned off in the stack is going to give you some improvement, not much. Three versus four, you know, as you can see, there's a diminishing return. So what is really important to note is the fact that, you know, if I could have two transistors in a stack turned off versus one, then I can get large improvement in leakage current. How about the other components of leakage? You know, there's gate leakage, there's junction tunneling leakage. What about the other components of leakage current? Now, let's look at 0, 0 again as a condition for gate leakage. Is it good or bad for gate leakage? It turns out it's very clear that if this is 0 and that's VDD, my gate to drain overlap leakage is going to be very high, right? So now one can figure out, I mean, the width of these arrows basically showing how important each of these leakage components or the gate leakage components are going to be. So it turns out that 0, 0 would give you an improvement in leakage current compared to if I didn't have such a stacking technique. But the interesting thing to note is that if I really look at gate leakage, then 1-0 might actually be a better component, and one can show that, than 0-0 in terms of getting an improvement. However, the thing to notice is that if I do have 0-0 at the inputs, then it still actually gives you improvement in gate leakage current. Junction band-to-band tunneling component. Again, one can do similar kind of analysis. Remember that we had actually the sum of current sources model. Yeah? And using that sum of current sources model, one can do an analysis of, again, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0 conditions for leakage. Remember that what we're really looking at is 1, 1 is not the important condition because both the transistors can be on. So at least one of the transistors have to be off in the stack for the leakage current to look at. It turns out that 1-0 gives maximum band-to-band tunneling leakage component. However, another interesting thing to note is that, yes, even though 1-0 is a better vector, using these input vectors, you don't really get that much of an improvement in the band-to-band tunneling component. So one can certainly ignore that band-to-band tunneling component from these input vector controller stacking. So now that we have analyzed, you know, this stacking technique and or source biasing technique, turns out, can I really apply to my logic circuits? So the basic idea, again, is that I have some logic block, and this can be, for example, a multiplier or an adder or some other complex logic blocks. It can be even simple logic blocks like NAND gates or NOR gates. What I can now do is I can add an extra transistor, right? Either on the NMOS side or on the PMOS side. I don't want to do both in the NMOS and the PMOS side. But if I do that, it turns out that when I'm not using this logic block, let's say for, you know, I've figured out that for a certain period of time in the standby mode, let's say I'm not going to be using this logic block, then of course what's possible is that I'm going to turn off this transistor. Okay? So if I know that I'm going to be using that transistor, what I can do is I can turn it off. Using it, then I can turn it on. So that one can show that this is actually basically, again, the same stacking technique. I'm applying a 0, and hopefully I have the input conditions for this logic block again satisfied, and in that case I can get a large improvement in leakage current. You've got to be careful. Anytime you're stacking like this, what's going to happen? The interesting thing to note is that your speed is going to get affected because you have series connected transistors either on the NMOS side or on the PMOS side. So you need to size these transistors large. Okay. The second thing is that not only that, these transistors can be shared among different logic blocks. Because in the standby mode, when I turn it off, you can actually have a large transistor to be shared among various logic gates. Remembering also the fact that not all these logic blocks are going to be switching at the same time. So I can be a little bit relaxed in terms of sizing these transistors. A few other things, when in the standby mode of operation, this is ground and this would be virtual ground. So again, depending on size of these transistors, this voltage, when I actually turn it off, this is not going to be ground. It's going to be floating up to a voltage of, let's say, 200 or 300 millivolts, depending on the size of these transistors. And that's basically what gives me a leakage improvement. Turns out that certainly it can be used in the standby mode of operation. The question, of course, is can I use it in the active mode of operation, these kind of technique. Now, what is the active mode of operation? Active mode of operation, I don't exactly know when to turn off these transistors, right? And the second thing, of course, is the fact that in the active mode of operation, my sub-threshold leakage current is going to be higher because my temperature also of the chip is going to be higher. Now, it turns out it's possible to do that. How do we do that in the standby mode of, in the active mode of operation? So let's take an example of a 3 to 8 decoder. So in this decoder, basically, if we take that example, and there's a pre-decoder which is shown here, what happens is in this decoder, either this set of logic in the top is going to be active, or this set of logic is going to be active, depending on the pre-decoder inputs. Okay. Is it possible that I put a gating transistor here and here, and this is going to be controlled by the pre-decoder? So the pre-decoder determines, of course, whether this part of the logic is going to be active or the other part of the logic is going to be active. And based on that, I'm really directly connecting it to this pre-decoder output. So if this is active, this transistor is going to be turned on, else the other transistor is going to be turned on. So if I do that, of course, I'm going to get some improvement in leakage current. And this time, the leakage improvement is going to be because of the active component of leakage. Second, a few other things to be careful about is that since I'm using this gating technique, you have to also understand that no spurious transitions is also going to be able to propagate beyond this point, right? So you also get an improvement due to the dynamic component of power dissipation, or in other words, your switching activity would reduce in the circuit. So if you look at the total power dissipation, which is the active power and the dynamic power dissipation of this 3-to-8 row decoder, and this was actually for a 70 nanometer and a 50 nanometer predictive technology, turns out that you can get a large improvement of the order of about 50 to 60% in the total power dissipation of this decoder. Now, this decoder example is kind of interesting, and it's very well suited for the kind of things that we are talking about, that either this half is going to be active or the other half is going to be active. Both halves are not going to be active at the same time. The question, of course, is it possible to apply this technique to any logic or any random logic? You know, certainly it's possible to apply to, circuitries like decoders and so on. Now, that's where actually Shannon-based expansion comes into picture. So what I can do now is, let's look at Shannon-based expansion and how it can be used, basically, for this kind of supply gating technique. Now, let's look at any function f. Any function f can be represented in terms of one of its literals, let's say xi, times the cofactor of f with respect to xi. What is the cofactor of f with respect to xi? Xi is equal to 1 in that expression. So in that expression for f, I put xi equal to 1. Cofactor of f with respect to xi bar, in that expression, I put xi equal to 0. And it turns out that this expression f can be represented in terms of xi times this cofactor of f with respect to xi plus xi bar times cofactor of f with respect to xi bar. So one can show that. One can represent it this way. Now, if I try to implement this circuit in this Shannon form, what I need to do is I'm going to have this cofactor of the function f with respect to x1, cofactor of function f with respect to xi bar. So I put a gating transistor here. What it really means is that this expression is going to be on, or this expression is going to be on. Both are not going to be on at the same time. And that's exactly what is evident from this expression right here. So now what happens is either this section of the logic is going to be on or this section of the logic is going to be on. Both are not going to be on at the same time. Got to be careful. You got to size these transistors up a little bit. And the second thing that you need to do is you also have to pre-decode the inputs. These inputs have to be available a little bit ahead of time. And that I could do actually in case of a decoder. In case of a decoder, I had a pre-decoding logic. So pre-decoder ahead of time tells me that, hey, this is going to be on or that is going to be on. I can turn it on a little bit ahead of time. I need to do such a thing when it comes to this kind of Shannon-based expansion. So pre-decoding some of these inputs so that I can turn on these gates a little bit ahead of time is going to be required. Otherwise, you're going to get a performance penalty. Second, of course, I need some muxes because depending on whether xi is equal to 1 or xi equal to 0, I should be selecting the right input. Third, who says that I have to stop right here? Can I take the cofactor off, you know, recursively take cofactors of this expression and keep on doing these kind of expansion? Few things one has to also realize is that I have not talked about sharing of logic between these different cofactors. There can be common sub-expressions, so there's sharing of logic, and that might actually be required. Otherwise, your area improvement is going to be increase might be too much. So once you have a shared logic, remember that you may not be using any one of these gating techniques for the shared logic. Okay? So one can make the right kind of trade-offs, the right kind of expansions, and if you do that, it turns out that for a number of benchmark circuits that we looked at, DSG, which is dynamic supply gating, versus the original circuit, which doesn't have any supply gating, again, you can get improvements, and the improvements really depend on the kind of logic functionality that you're looking at. On an average, I think, and we implemented that, some of these circuits actually, in a 130 nanometer process technology, we did the measurements, and we found that the total power improvement was of the order of about 30% or so. So it turns out, again, looking at the right leakage control technique gives you an improvement and gives you an improvement not just in the active component of the leakage power, but also at the same time, dynamic component of the leakage power because no spurious transitions are going to be propagating through the off part of the circuitry. A few other things I thought it's kind of interesting to note is that even though you might be using supply gating, this can be used in test also. So you don't have to be familiar with the testing technique, but the basic idea is that when I actually design something, when I design a circuit, there's a need for testing of those circuits too. How do you to make sure that the circuits really work after fabrication? A few things, a few testing techniques turns out to be important are, you know, earlier people looked at IDDQ, the quiescent current of the circuit, and looking at the quiescent current of the circuit, people would say that is there failure short or in some cases open failures in the circuit or not. And similarly, people look at stack at being 0, stack at 1, and so on for testing of the circuit. Now, in order to do a good job for testing, it turns out that I need good controllability of the internal nodes of the circuit. And not only good controllability, good observability of the circuit, because I should be able to apply test vectors to the circuit and be able to say if there's a faulty condition inside the circuit or not. Now, it turns out that using supply gating, the technique that I just talked about, you are separating different sections of the circuit. And hence, it turns out you can get an improvement in IDDQ, the sensitivity of the IDDQ, because you're using, again, the gating technique, and gating technique improves the quiescent current, or improves meaning, I mean, lowers the quiescent current of the circuit. So it turns out you can use this technique to actually reduce the quiescent current, and quiescent current is becoming, I mean, this IDDQ testing is becoming a major problem because of the variations in the threshold voltage, and also at the same time, threshold voltage being low, your quiescent current is actually high. Now, this technique actually would reduce the quiescent current and would enhance the IDDQ sensitivity, because if there's a short between two lines, of course, that would show up more under a lower leakage condition than if my total leakage is too high. A few other things, there's an improvement in test power, because I can turn off different sections of the circuitry as I want. And finally, there's an improvement in test coverage too. And this test coverage really comes from the fact that I have controllability of the different sections of the circuitry. Okay? So I get a better test coverage. Another interesting thing to note is that supply gating can be used in scan design. And those of you are familiar with the scan designs, in a sequential logic circuit, what happens is that it's very difficult to apply proper test vectors to the combinational part of the circuit. So what people do is they use scan techniques, meaning thereby that I this is my regular combinational circuit, and I put some added latches or actually added circuitry so that not during the regular operation, but during the test mode, what I can do is I can scan in certain vectors into my latches, and after I scan in the vectors in, I can apply it to my combinational logic circuit very effectively. And that would be in the test mode. It turns out that when you're scanning in vectors in the in your latches, this is a combinational part of the circuit. You don't want any activities, any switching activities in the combinational part of the circuit at that time because you're just scanning in vectors. So what people do is they would put in some blocking logic right here so that the switching activities wouldn't propagate. So instead of doing it using these NOR-based blocking techniques or some other blocking techniques, which actually takes up some area, the question is it possible that I use first level of gating that I was talking about? It turns out you can use it only in the first level of logic, this supply gating technique. And if you turn off these transistors during when you're scanning in the vectors, in that case, of course, you can reduce the switching activity at the internal nodes of the circuit. And again, you can get quite a bit of improvement. Not to worry about the details of the results here, but what is really important to note is that compared to the standard NOR-based gating technique, this gives you quite a bit of area improvement, about 62% in this particular case. And the delay overhead is also a lot lower in this technique. And of course, at the same time, you can get a leakage improvement too during the test mode. Finally, I thought another idea kind of interesting to note is that when you do delay testing, this was actually stuck at fault testing. When you do delay testing, it turns out when you scan in the vectors, it's in order to actually activate a particular path in your circuit, there's a need to actually have modified the scan chain. Why? Because in general, for delay testing, what you really need is you would like to apply a vector V1 followed by a vector V2 so that a transition would propagate to a particular path and can detect that changes, transition 1 to 0, 0 to 1 at the output. It requires actually you change this scan chain into what is called an enhanced scan chain, and that actually requires a large area. Turns out, instead of doing that, you can still use a gating technique. It's sort of like a half latch which stores the value at the output of this first level of logic, and then along with gating, one can effectively apply delay testing technique even using gating. How much of an improvement? Again, not to worry about the details of the results, but how much of an improvement can you get? It turns out compared to enhanced scan, which is quite expensive, the area overhead is about 33% less and about 71% less delay overhead. And interestingly enough, certainly a lot less power overhead, about 90% less overhead in terms of power dissipation. So these are some of the techniques that the gating technique not only can be just applied to leakage reduction, but can also be applied to other test circuitries and so on. Another interesting scenario is decoupling capacitors. So it turns out these VDD lines and the ground lines are going to be associated with some sort of inductance, right? And so when things are switching, when you have a DIDT to be high, the rate of change of current to be high, then of course there's going to be LDIDT drop on the VDD lines. Now, to take care of such a thing, what people do is sometimes they attach actually a decoupling capacitor. It's like a low-pass filter. You apply a decoupling capacitor to the VDD lines or ground lines. Now, the bad thing about connecting a decoupling capacitor is that there can be leakage current because you're using these transistors with the source and the drain of the transistor connected together, and with the gate and the source you can get a capacitor with the source and the drain connected together, and you're using these transistors as capacitors. And if you do that, it turns out there can be a good amount of leakage current because these transistors are going to be huge. In order to get good amount of capacitance, these transistors have to be huge. So what in one of the papers from IBM showed that there's a large gate decap leakage power. So how do I actually reduce the gate leakage for these decoupling capacitors? So if I look at this particular decoupling capacitor connected to the VDD line, and this is some functional unit, it turns out that there can be a good amount of leakage current, a gate leakage current through these devices. And can I reduce that gate leakage current? Turns out that a gating technique might be useful. And in this particular case, again, this is a standard way of like implementing the gating transistor, the decoupling capacitor. And now actually in this case, I add an extra transistor. Okay, and this is a supply gating transistor. And the basic idea of that supply gating transistor would be to reduce, in this particular case, the current flowing through these devices, and which is going to be the gate leakage of this particular device. Got to be careful. You have to turn on and off this transistor based on the fact when the when that functional unit is going to be active versus when it's not active. So if I know the functional unit is not going to be active, I can turn it off. If I know it's going to be active, I have to turn it on or keep it on, right? So if you do that, and I'm not going to go into the details of how to do it, but assuming that you're able to do it, it turns out that this gated decap versus the conventional decap has a little bit of overhead, you know, because of these extra gating transistors and so on, about 7% overhead. But interestingly enough, that again, not to worry about the details of all these benchmark circuits, but the average decap leakage power reduction in this case was about, you know, 42% or so. So just to give you an idea that it is possible to apply these techniques even for, you know, decoupling capacitors or testing and so on, not just for leakage control. A few other things one can do is one can use body biasing in a transistor. I certainly have a fourth terminal available, and that's a body terminal. By applying a bias to that terminal, either forward body bias or reverse body bias, I got to be careful. I can't apply any bias. Right? There are several reasons why I can't apply any bias. If I go back to the analysis of my transistors, of course, if I apply a forward bias of the order of about 700 millivolts, my junctions are all going to turn on and my device is not going to really act as a transistor. On the other side, if I apply a very strong reverse bias, remember, my junction band-to-band tunneling current would increase. Right? So I got to be careful. But then again, if I apply a forward body bias, my right amount of forward body bias, my junction band-to-band tunneling current would decrease, and my threshold voltage actually would also decrease, right? Similarly, if I apply a reverse body bias, my threshold voltage would increase, and my sub-threshold leakage would decrease, but my band-to-band tunneling leakage would increase. And most of these techniques wouldn't have much of an impact on the gate leakage. So if I look at this analysis, and I can, you know, model all these sort of different components of leakage, it turns out, if I plot, for example, substrate voltage or the body bias voltage versus the normalized current, let's say, what I'm going to see is that when I apply a forward body bias, my sub-threshold leakage current, which is shown here, is going to increase. My substrate leakage, which is the band-to-band tunneling leakage, is going to decrease. Gate leakage remaining more or less the same over that body bias condition. I get an optimum condition somewhere here. And that optimum condition can be a forward condition or a reverse condition depending on the doping profile and so on. So again, at room temperature. Remember, at higher temperature, of course, it's going to be dominated by the subthreshold component of the leakage. Now, one of the interesting things to note is that depending on the kind of doping profiles and the transistor that you have, using the modeling technique that I sort of mentioned earlier, for a 70 nanometer technology for leakage reduction versus a 50 nanometer technology for leakage reduction, it turns out you can get, using body bias, a good amount of leakage reduction. You've got to look at different components of leakage. But interesting to note is that in this particular technology, the reverse body bias turns out to be the optimum condition. In this case, the forward body bias turns out to be the optimum condition. And again, really because of the fact that there are different components of leakage current. Another technique that turns out to be quite important is also dual VT. Who says that I need one single threshold voltage for my design? Is it possible that I can use two different threshold voltages? Absolutely. You can certainly use two different threshold voltages. How to use that? There are different ways of using it. And one way would be to look at a, let's say, a large circuit. And in that circuit, certainly I have some critical paths. The critical paths should have a low threshold voltage to get an improvement in the critical path delay. And the off-critical paths are going to have a high threshold voltage. How do I determine that? I need to come up with the right, good algorithm to do it. A good algorithm to actually place or assign critical, assign threshold voltage to these different parts of the circuit. The basic idea is that if I look at a path distribution, this is basically, let's say, this is a cartoon showing the path distribution, showing if I were to have all high VT transistors, my path distribution looks somewhat like this. If I were to have all low VT, this path distribution is moved this side, right? It's going to look somewhat like this. And if I have a dual VT design, then of course I don't want to change my critical path. That critical path remains the same. But since I'm using a lower threshold here and in the off-critical paths higher threshold, I get a much sharper or squeezed distribution for the critical paths. But turns out, yes, it's going to give you a large improvement in leakage current, not just sub-threshold leakage, not just the improvement in standby leakage, but also the active mode leakage component that's going to improve. It turns out that your delays, in fact, the dynamic power is also going to improve. Why? Because since all your paths are more or less same delay, your switching activity due to glitches is going to reduce. And finally, one other thing that turns out to be important is that since I'm using, in some cases, high VT, the internal node swings of those logic gates are also going to be lower. It's going to be VDD minus VT high as opposed to VDD minus VT low. So you can get a large improvement. Total power can be reduced by 22% at low activity, but 9% at high activity, and in the standby mode to almost about 80% or so. Got to be careful in the future technology generations, because what I'm really getting is a much sharper distribution, okay, of paths. So now if I do have variations in the threshold voltages, do I have variations in L, effective length of the transistors, and so on, turns out that I can have some spread in that distribution. And since I have a large number of critical paths in my design, then I can have the probability of failure is going to be high under such a condition. So what one needs to do is one needs to look at the impact on the parametric yield. And that turns out to be important. And again, need to consider variations when you do the VT assignment, you know, threshold voltage variation. You need a good amount of separation between the low VT, high VT, or medium VT if you want, so that your variations are still going to be considered. And again, you need a new algorithm to do that. And again, I'm not talking about these algorithms. In the next few minutes, I'm going to switch gear a little bit and talk about memories. So far what we talked about are logic. Now, why are memories important? In today's technology, what I find is that if I look at the high-performance scenario, memories take up almost like, you know, 70 to 80% of the die area in a high-performance scenario. And the other interesting thing to note is that if I look at these L1 caches or L2 caches, and assuming that the L1 is the first level of cache, which is a fast cache, and L2 is the higher level of, meaning the larger cache in my die, turns out that the power dissipation in the L1 cache, which is accessed, you know, quite often, is about 30% to 35% of the total power dissipation. Is actually leakage is about 30 to 35% of the total power dissipation. In the larger caches, in the L2 caches and so on, since the accesses are not going to be that often, right? In that case, what I find is that the power dissipation in those caches, the L2 caches, is probably going to be close to 80% or so, and that's 80% is leakage power. So what can we do about leakage in memories? And memories, remember, take up a good amount of die area. These L2 caches do take a good amount of die area. Can I use my same basic technique, you know, supply gating? But I got to be a little bit careful about memories because I don't want to lose value in my memory. Anytime I apply a technique, I got to be careful that I do not lose value from my memory, right? So that turns out to be important. So what we did is we did an analysis of memories. And remember, I'm talking about these 6-transistor cells. And there are only a few terminals available in a 6-transistor cell. I mean, you can consider the body to be one terminal. You have this, you know, a source to be other terminals. You have also the bit lines to be some terminals and so on. And it turns out you can basically look at a few different options in memory cells. And the few different options turns out to be you can do source biasing, forward body biasing, you know, dynamic VDD, floating bit lines, negative word lines, and so on. And I'm not going to go into the details of it, but it turns out that our analysis showed that these might actually be the most important techniques for memories. So again, stacking or source biasing comes into picture. We'll see that dynamic also body biasing turns out to be also kind of interesting for memories. And it shows really that any time you apply these techniques, there's going to be a reduction in the gate leakage, subthreshold leakage. In some cases, actually, the band-to-band tunnel leakage might increase and so on, depending on the kind of devices that I'm using. It would also have an impact on delay. There's going to be some overhead. And it turns out in memory, stability considerations are absolutely important. So I need to consider stability considerations too. So I need to do all those sort of things. Another interesting thing to note is that in today's technology, it's very, very important that you're able to do some device circuit co-design. And that's going to be apparent, actually, when we look at memories. So in fact, one of the interesting things to note is that depending on the kind of devices that you would use, you might actually use, for example, a bulk ultra-high VT device or a bulk nominal VT device. Or let's say that, you're possibly trying to use SOI and you're using a ground plane SOI. Or maybe you're trying to use a FinFET kind of device in the future technology generations. And it turns out, depending on the kind of devices that you use, your circuit techniques are going to be different. Your leakage components are going to be different. So one has to optimize your devices in such a way that you can use a proper circuit technique. And we'll see that. And that turns out to be quite important when we look at memories and leakage and so on. So this device circuit co-design turns out to be quite important. Finally, in fact, it's can be quite evident also that the microarchitectural design issues turns out to be important too. So one has to look at all these three things at the same time: circuit, devices, and microarchitectural issues. And we'll see that in just a minute, how each of these techniques can play a big role in coming up with the right memory for your designer. So this is actually one example showing that device circuit co-design is important. And I'm not talking about variations, but it turns out, even from the variational point of view, it turns out it's quite an important technique. In particular, what I'm going to be focusing on is bulk technology. I'm not talking about FinFETs, but if you're interested, I can refer you to some of the work on FinFETs or the ground plane SOI. But let's look at bulk, and let's try to see if we start looking at nominal VT transistors, what are the circuit techniques and the architectural techniques that we can use. So again, let's consider nominal VT bulk. Turns out the circuit technique that's going to be effective for such a case is going to be source biasing, okay? And we need to look at proper microarchitecture and use a locality of reference in the microarchitecture to get improvement in leakage. So all these three techniques are going to be working hand in hand. So I'm talking about a nominal VT cache, 6-transistor cache. Again, now let's say I'm storing a value of 0 or 1 on one side, and it turns out there are different leakage paths in my cache from VDD to ground, from bit lines to ground. How do I stop it, or at least reduce my leakage? My good old transistor stacking technique comes into picture. So I actually put a transistor stack. If I'm not accessing that particular section of the cache, I turn it off. Next question is, if I turn it off, what happens to my logic 0 and logic 1 that I might have stored here? Turns out, the logic 1, one can show, is going to be remaining more or less logic 1. What happens to logic 0? Since this voltage is going to go up to about hundreds of millivolts, depending on the size of this transistor, this 0 is also going to go up to about 200 or 300 millivolts, depending on the sizes that I have for these transistors. So I'm not going to lose the value. That's important. So what I can now do is that this technique, the stacking technique, I can use it also for gate leakage. So let's not go into the details of it, but it turns out it can actually give you a gate leakage improvement too, the total gate leakage improvement. But it turns out that this transistor now that I'm talking about, the gate control transistor, can be shared among all these cache lines, right? So I can have a long cache line, and this can be the gating control transistor, which can be shared. And I can get a large improvement in leakage due to stacking. Few things which turns out to be important are that how big this transistor should be. It turns out this transistor has to be big. And the reason is it has to sink in a good amount of current from all these different caches. So this transistor has to be big. So how do I actually implement this transistor? Because in cache, turns out area is very, very important. So what I can really do is, this is the implementation of my regular cache. And then on top of that, what I really do is on the side, I actually put this gating transistor. Now this gating transistor has to pitch match with the cell, so I can make it to be a large number of parallel transistors to pitch match the cell of the cache. How much of an area penalty do I pay? About 3 to 4% of the total cache area. So which isn't too bad. Few other things turns out to be important is that who's going to be controlling this transistor? So a nice way of doing it would be to actually have row decoder control it. So I have the row decoder. It's going to be turning on this section of the cache and actually connect it directly. You don't want to do it connected directly because, you know, you don't want to turn, if you know that you're going to be accessing this area of the cache, you'd like to turn it on a little bit ahead of time. Why? The reason being, otherwise there's going to be a performance penalty, right? So if you turn it on a little bit ahead of time, you're probably okay. So what kind of cache architecture that one can think of under this nominal VT condition? Remember that I have gating technique that I just talked about. So these are the gating transistors. I turn on and off this, if I turn on and off this transistor too often, then I'm going to be paying a dynamic power penalty, right? So how do I reduce that? That's where microarchitecture comes into picture. You know? So when I look at the architectural technique, you know, my architectural friends tell me that if I go and access a certain section of the memory, it turns out there's a good possibility I'll be accessing that section of the memory again in the near future. Why? That's because of the locality of reference. In general, what happens is if you look at an instruction cache, if I'm going at looking at instruction I, then most probably I'm going to be going to instruction I plus 1, I plus 2 in the next cycles and so on. Okay? So it turns out I can do that. So if I have a certain section of the cache, if I access that section of the cache, I keep this transistor on. How long do I keep it on? Because there can be another access in the near future, right? So I have a self-decay circuitry. It determines, actually, it slowly decays, but if I have another access over there, it goes back to that original value, right? So I do not turn it off. If I do not have access for a long, long time, the self-decay circuitry basically would actually turn off this transistor, okay? So that's how I can take care of some of these architectural issues. Few other things, should I keep this transistor, this gating transistor, I said keep it on one side. It turns out it's okay to keep it on one side, but you can have a current crowding problem. On one side, the current is going to be crowded, and hence, I might want to distribute it a little bit across the array. Okay? So that's what is shown there. Now, this was actually implemented in a 180 nanometer process technology. In 180 nanometers, remember that the most important thing was the subthreshold component of the leakage current. And what kind of improvement one can get from this cache compared to a standard cache where there are no gating techniques were used. So this is the conventional cache results and talking about junction leakage, you know, bit line leakage, cell leakage, and so on. But it turns out that you can get about 94% improvement in this cache by using this gating technique properly. So this is kind of interesting. You know, is it going to be that 94% in scale technologies? The answer is probably not. And the reason is there will be other important components of leakage current that you have to look at, you know, gate leakage, junction leakage, and so on. They will actually reduce this improvement a little bit. And we'll see that. Can I use forward body biasing for the cache? Remember what I said? You need to do some sort of a device circuit core design, right? If my starting point is a nominal VT design, then I could do actually stacking. But if my starting point is a high VT transistor, high VT means lower performance, right? But lower leakage also at the same time. So if my starting point is high VT, then in order to get my performance up, I need to do something else. So in this particular case, what I do is a forward body biasing. Rather than stacking that I did earlier, what I can really do is forward body biasing. So if I'm accessing a particular area of the cache, I forward body bias that section of the cache. If I'm not accessing, I keep it at the high VT. Okay, so that's the basic idea. I need a triple well process technology for that. So my technology changes a little bit too. What kind of architectural issues that I need to do? Remember, I do not want to turn on and off my body all the time. I'll be switching a good amount of capacitance, and there'll be noise also associated with that. Again, locality of reference comes into picture. I'm not going to be turning on and off quite frequently. If I have access to a certain section of the cache, I'm going to keep it actually in forward bias condition for a while. Self-decay circuitry again comes into picture, and I can take care of things. Showing basically the transistor characteristics that we looked at, and this was actually a 50 nanometer technology. It's our the devices that we actually predictive technology devices. And what it really shows is that the drain current versus gate voltage characteristic for a super high VT device with zero body bias, and of course super high VT with forward body bias and nominal VT with zero body bias conditions. Just to show what characteristics of the transistors that we looked at. This is my array. And for remember, what I was going to do is apply a forward body bias. And in this particular case, I was looking at a 32 by 32 forward body biased subarray condition. Why 32 by 32? For this kind of technology, the amount of switching that I would have for the body capacitances was suited for this 32 by 32. It doesn't, you're not limited by that. It's just an example. Comparison, conventional cache, no source biasing or body biasing, source biased SRAM versus a forward body biased SRAM for a 50 nanometer technology shows about, you know, for the source body bias and the forward body bias, about, you know, 60% reduction. So both were very, very similar, as you can see. These techniques are very similar, using a different circuit technique, different devices, but giving you very similar results. This is going to cost you a little more in terms of the forward body biasing because I need, you know, triple well process technology. And again, each of these techniques will affect actually the subthreshold component of the leakage, the junction band-to-band tunneling component of the leakage, and possibly gate leakage, not in this particular case, but certainly gate leakage here. So it's not 94% improvement in this particular case. It turns out for this 50 nanometer technology, it turns out about, you know, 64% or so. And again, an example. Can these techniques be applied to flip-flops? Since flip-flops are also memories, it turns out you can apply these techniques and you're not going to lose the value. And again, our results, and this was implemented again in a 180 nanometer technology, a shift register showing about 40% power reduction by going from, you know, power down mode to the power up mode. Power down mode is going to give you that improvement. Finally, in the next couple of minutes, and this can possibly be another breeze lecture, I guess, is that you know, leakage is bad, and I would like to get rid of leakage in most of the cases. And but it turns out, and I usually say it, it's a little controversial, but I say it usually, that subthreshold is a good leakage, as opposed to, you know, gate leakage versus band-to-band tunnel leakage or gate-induced drain leakage, GIDL, which I didn't talk about. It turns out that subthreshold is a good leakage. Why is it a good leakage? Why do I say it's a good leakage? The reason being, when the subthreshold leakage is low, then I actually get the lower performance. But if the subthreshold leakage is high, then I get a better performance. My VT is actually lower, right? And that's basically the, you know, if you look at large microprocessors and which are designed using, let's say, nominal VT transistors, it turns out you're going to get a good amount of variations. And due to that, such variations, you'll find out that some chips which are leaky are actually faster. The chips which are non-leaky, assuming they're all working, the chips which are non-leaky are actually slower. So that's kind of interesting. So it's actually good if I have higher leakage, you know, price I pay, but I get a higher frequency. But interestingly enough, the subthreshold component of the leakage is, when I look at that leakage, I'm usually in the exponential region. A little bit of change in VGS is going to give me an exponential change in leakage current. And I get my GM of the transistor to be really good. And so what happens is, if I can somehow make sure that if I'm only working in this region, my VDD is less than the threshold voltage. My, of course, all inputs are also less than the threshold voltage. And my voltage swing is from, let's say, 0 to VT as an example. It doesn't have to be VT. It can be lower than VT too. It turns out I can get a very good voltage transfer characteristic. Okay. Interestingly enough, of course, in that region, my capacitance is also lower. Okay? The transistor intrinsic capacitance is also going to be lower. So can I use it to do any useful operations? And it turns out, yes, I can actually get a good voltage transfer characteristic. However, the problem, of course, is the fact that you're not going to get much of a performance. Your performance is going to be lower, right? So you might be actually working in the range of kilohertz to hertz and so on. Hundreds of hertz to kilohertz and so on, right? But there are lots of applications where highest performance is not required. So you can certainly do that. Few questions. So why don't I use it? This, in this region, it turns out any variations is going to play a major role, right? It's going to, you're going to see things changing in an exponential fashion, right? So variation, got to make it variation tolerant. And the second thing is that if I want a little bit higher performance, if I want performance in the megahertz range, of course, I'm not going to be able to get gigahertz performance here. But if I were to get performance in the megahertz range, I got to do something about it. So what are the things that I can do? So let's look at this computing with leakage scenario where I'm talking about sub-threshold leakage. And let's look at a cartoon. It's power versus throughput. So let's say I'm hit the power ceiling right here. Is it possible that I scale my supply voltage down? And this is just a cartoon showing that, yes, you know, I can keep on scaling my supply voltage down. How far can I go? Till my voltage transfer characteristics are not really giving me any gain, right? So one can show, theoretically, that you can go down to about 2L and 2 KT log 2. And, of course, we may not be able to go that far, right? But it's possible to go about 3 KT log 2. Now, but my performance goes down, but my power goes down. So what can I do? Is it possible that I do some device optimization? Who says that I should really use the same super threshold devices? Can I use devices which are suitable for sub-threshold operation? Remember, I do not need a strong halo in these devices, right? I can do without a strong halo in my device because DIBL is not going to be that much of a problem. My VDD is a lot lower. Is it possible they get some, I can certainly have a little bit better performance, a little bit better throughput using just the devices, better devices. Is it, and then some of these might actually be good for medical applications and so on. Is it possible that I use my circuit techniques to get my performance up? Circuit techniques like using the proper kind of circuit, pseudo NMOS kind of circuits turns out to be is quite important in this. And actually they work very well. Pseudo NMOS do not work well in the super threshold region. One can show that. I'm not going to go into the details of it, but it turns out you can use parallel processing, pipelining, and the proper circuit techniques to get it up. You're not going to be able to go all the way up there, but it's certainly possible to go up. What happens if you would like to switch back and forth between sub-threshold and super threshold region? Then of course you can't do this device optimization. In that case, of course, what you have to do is you have no device optimization. You'll probably follow a path like this, which I haven't shown here, right? So it's possible. And there are lots of applications in this domain, wireless applications and so on. If you go up to megahertz range, you can use those kind of applications. So what I showed earlier was just a cartoon, but it turns out it's possible. And this is actually what we implemented. It's actually a 5-tap FIR filter. I'm not showing you the details of the devices, device optimizations of the circuit techniques, but it really shows is that it's possible to scale my supply voltage down, and this was all the way up to 150 millivolts or so. Then doing device optimization, taking circuits and architecture optimization path, and getting some of my performance back. Okay, so it's possible to do that. And we have done it actually for not just bulk, but also SOI kind of technologies. And it's possible to get these improvements. So this is kind of very, very interesting. Now, just to give you an idea that it's possible, actually, we have designed now chips which are working at about 85 millivolts for an FIR, 8-tap FIR filter, which is kind of very, very interesting. And about 40 nanowatts of power dissipation. So the power dissipation is really, really low. And in fact, more recently also, some of the memory circuits have been designed to work all the way down to, 150 or 160 millivolts or so. Again, I'm not talking much about those today. So in conclusions, what I feel is that the power considerations are absolutely important, and but we certainly have a good handle on some of these things. We know how to reduce dynamic power dissipation using VDD scaling, looking at the proper architectures, looking at the proper algorithms, optimizing the capacitances or switch capacitances where possible. But it turns out leakage is also very, very important, and not leakage just in the standby mode of operation, because all your handheld applications, your cell phones and so on, if your leakage is too high, your battery life is going to be very, very low, right? So it turns out that leakage has turned out to be quite an important problem, not just the standby leakage, but also the active mode leakage. And that turns out to be quite important too. So leakage control techniques are becoming essential. Leakage problem is certainly expected to be there, just like variations. And as I mentioned earlier, variations is going to be there too. But leakage is also expected to be there, not just in silicon, bulk silicon technologies, but also variations of bulk silicon technologies, like double gate transistors, or in fact, if we go to non-silicon technologies too, leakage can be an issue. So one can certainly use some of these circuit techniques that I just mentioned today for effective reducing leakage current in my devices and circuits. However, what I'm what I think is important is to note the fact that not only it can be used in leakage control, some of these techniques are actually useful for improving, for example, the testability of the circuits also. So it's not just for one application. I feel not just from the leakage point of view, but leakage in nanometer scale technologies, process variation in nanometer scale technologies, and so on, there's a need to take an integrated approach to design, which is device, circuit, and architecture co-design. By the way, that's not very simple, but certainly there's a need to actually consider these things in the design methodologies, and the design methodologies are probably going to be a little bit different from what people have been considering so far. And finally, which I didn't talk much about, is that sub-threshold leakage can be quite interesting, and you can scale your supply voltage down to VDD less than VT. And of course, there are some limits that you have to look at, but certainly you can scale your supply voltage down to less than VT, and you can still do interesting computing, not for the highest performance, but certainly for ultra-low power dissipation. And again, it turns out in this domain, this device circuit architecture co-design would play a very, very important role. Okay? So that's all I have.
Questions? So you were saying that using this stack transistors, you can increase the leakage current. So in the active mode, can you also decrease the dynamic power dissipation because the transistors are not directly connected to the ground? Is it possible to also decrease the dynamic power dissipation?
The dynamic power dissipation, yes, sure. So what you're really talking about is a dynamic VDD technique, right?
Right. I'm just saying that in an inverter type of circuit, we see this triangular currents, right, when both are, one is going off and one is going on. Mm-hmm. Now, because those are not directly connected to the ground in the stack transistor technique.
In the active mode of operation, the stack transistor, this bottom transistor that I was talking about, gated ground or gated VDD, that transistor is turned on.
But I'm saying that, is it conceivable that you can change the clock a little bit to make sure that, to decrease that current, or it is not?
You mean to say, can I just skew the clock a little bit? And in some cases, actually, skewing is done. Some intentional skewing is done to actually improve delay in most of the cases. But maybe we should talk about it in a little more detail. But in general, what happens is the stacking transistor is going to be on during the regular mode of operation. And that's what you really need. And you need that transistor to be large because it has to sink in a good amount of current here. Otherwise, your performance there's going to be a performance penalty. But can be certainly used in active mode and also in the standby mode of operation. But the way you use it in the active mode and standby mode is going to be different. Any other questions?